This week on Out of the Air, a whole show features author Michael Schreiber, whose first book, One Man Show, The Life and Art of Bernard Perlin, discussing his new book, Don Bacardi, An Artist's Life, about his Hollywood life as an acclaimed portrait artist. Our spotlight's on Grant Fitch about his one-man rendition of Dickens' holiday classic, A Christmas Carol, at Fort Street Theater, and Footlight Players' production of I Regret Nothing.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, WVLP 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is heard every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Also heard on Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at wvlp.org. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Media. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight, and he's been with us before talking about the various things in theater. He's very active in local theater throughout Northwest Indiana, but he's going to be involved in a couple of shows coming up, one of which is kind of an annual event for him, and we're going to talk to him about those shows. And it's Grant Fitch, and welcome back to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Hello, thanks. Welcome. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, good to
always
see you again.
To be here.
Well, you're involved in two upcoming productions. You just finished being in The Bluff at Footlight Players, but now you're going to be in another one coming up in November. So tell us a little bit about that.
This is called I Regret Nothing. It was 2 years ago I was involved with it. So it's a neat kind of a chance to return to the same wonderful script, same wonderful character. And that one 2 years ago was the American premiere of this story set in Romania a few years ago after the Romanian Revolution. I play a retired, torturer. It's a little bit of a stretch for me, but in a little apartment in Romania, he swears he doesn't regret the life he lived, the life he gave to his country. But I'll let the audience decide how much he really does regret or not regret. It's a fascinating story. There's a lot of drama to it and more comedy than you think there's going to be. We have a new cast this time, same director, and I'm really looking forward to tackling it again. It's going to be a very powerful show, entertaining. People were talking about it for a long time after, which is why we've done this semi-revival. This is going to be performed two weekends in November at Footlight Players in Michigan City, and I'm very, very excited to get it into it again and to share it with some new audiences.
How many people are in the cast, Grant?
It is a three-person play. I'm on stage the whole time. This is all in my apartment. It's a series of two-person scenes where a younger man who is still active in the secret police comes to me, and he's trying to draw me back out of retirement for one last job. Alternating scenes with him, with the young, innocent teenager who lives upstairs. And my growing friendship with her softens my character, but also weakens him, I think, to pressure from outside.
Sure.
We'll put it that way. So, it's a fascinating character study for these three characters, and a wonderful showcase for three actors.
Well, that's going to be November 13th through 16th in 2023, Footlight Players. And you can see it there and find out information, of course, at footlightplayers.org. But now you do an annual event that's very important, kind of been a fixture of Northwest Indiana. And tell us all about that.
I have been somehow, wasn't deliberate, somehow I've ended up doing a one-man Christmas carol for more than 20 years in local theater. 4th Street Theater in Chesterton has been very generous and kind to have me out there for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years in a row now. We started doing just one performance, and they liked it enough. They added a second and then a third. And then this season, they have added a fourth performance. So I'm going to do 4 shows at 4th Street Theater in Chesterton, 2 on Thanksgiving weekend, and then 2 more the weekend following, the first weekend in December. I was drawn to the story of Christmas Carol. I mean, we all grew up watching so many different versions over the years on television, and I just loved the story. And I loved the original Dickens text. So once when I was working for a library and doing some children's library, storytelling, I thought maybe I can do something for adults, for the whole family. And I thought just once I'll adapt it into a reading and perform it, doing all the voices and everything. And that proved so popular that I ended up doing it again. And then again, a few more times. And after about 5 years, I ended up memorizing it completely, wow, turning it into a full theatrical performance with lighting cues and sound effects and pieces of music and such. And so I do it every year at schools or libraries or retirement homes, theaters, etc. So at churches, you know, so I've been all over. All over Illinois and Indiana with it. And I've been really happy to find a home at 4th Street Theater for several years now.
Are you doing it anywhere else than 4th Street during the holiday season?
Still working on that. I believe I'm going to be in Illinois. I want to say Orland Park, okay, Somewhere new. And then there's always some bookstores and churches that I talked to about potentially doing October creepy classics gigs and or Christmas time storytelling. So we're working on some of those things. So I keep busy.
Yeah. So Grant, does the costuming stay the same and the stage props that you use, or does it get mixed up all year after year?
I use the same basic props and minor costume changes. But what's interesting is that every time I'm in a new space, the staging changes somewhat by necessity.
Yes.
And what's fun at 4th Street and any other theater where I'm doing it, I'm doing it in front of a church, I use their space. But at 4th Street, I always reuse the set of whatever show we just got done doing it. So once I was in a pirate ship, and once I was in an Irish farmhouse.
Well, we're at the end here. That's Grant Fitch, Christmas Carol, November 29th, December 6th. Other dates on the weekends there. You can find it at 4th Street Theater and also be at Footlight Players. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight and sharing your arts and theater journey.
Thank you, Grant.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Art on the Air Spotlight and the complete one-hour program on Sunday is brought to you by Emberforge Consulting, thoughtful marketing and digital learning built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. Art on the Air listeners, do you have a suggestion for a possible guest on our show? Whether it's an artist, musician, author, gallery, theater, concert, or some other artistic endeavor that you are aware of, or a topic of interest to our listeners, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. This is Pledge Week for your public radio station, and Art on the Air encourages our loyal listeners to support this station by making a monthly sustaining pledge so we may continue to bring you this great program.
This is author Christopher Grayson, and you're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
We are pleased to welcome Michael Schreiber to Art on the Air. Michael is a writer, curator, and teacher based in Chicago. As a multi-award recipient, he is the author of three books. His debut book, One Man Show, The Life and Art of Bernard Perlin, was named Stonewall Honor Book and is being adapted into a feature-length film. He is also the executor of the artistic estate of Bernard Perlin, and as such has curated multiple solo exhibitions. American House, Frank Lloyd Wright's Meyer House and the American System Built Homes is the second book written in collaboration with his husband, Jason Loper. His current book, released August 28th of 2025, is Don Bacardi, An Artist's Life. It is an unfiltered and intimate chronicle of Don Bacardi and his life partner, Christopher Isherwood. For over the last 30 years, he is a teacher and life coach for children and young adults with autism. Thank you for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome, Michael. It is a joy to be meeting you.
Aloha, and thank you so much for having me.
Well, Michael, our audience always wants to know about the origin story of our guests. I always like to tee it up is by saying how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Michael.
It all began in a town called Fargo. I am a native of Fargo, North Dakota. Somehow I survived the wood chipper. And I'm here to tell a lot of tales. I grew up in Fargo, had a wondrous childhood there, went to school, and always had an abiding interest in art history, American history in general. So my first stop on the college tour was to get a degree in American Studies, and I did that at Minnesota State University in Moorhead. When I was there, it was called Moorhead State University. And from there, I went to New York City. So that was quite a leap to go to NYU, to graduate school, this time in cinema studies, because I have had a passionate interest in particularly the golden age of Hollywood since I was 10, 11 years old, staying up late nights and watching movies on the Late Late Show on our local PBS station. In the days before cable television, and once more movies, old movies particularly, started getting shown on those networks, I was off to the races. So really my interests in art and in film and in history all intersected through my college years. And out of college, I thought, well, what to do with all of this? I thought perhaps I might want to try my hand at filmmaking. Of course, I have no technical skills whatsoever. So I moved to Chicago with a good friend. We decided to live a very sort of bohemian life here. She was singing in blues clubs and acting in local theater. And I got a camera and started making what I thought was going to be an Oscar-winning short film. I never completed it. In the meantime, to pay the bills, I began working with young kiddos with special needs, kiddos on the autism spectrum with Down syndrome and other unique abilities. And that unexpected career just took off, or I should say an unexpected career took off. I absolutely fell in love with the work I was doing with these young people. And to this day, nearly 30 years later, I'm still doing it, although part-time now, as the writing career has taken off.
And so all of this, actually, I want to go back to like young you. Yeah. Back in like elementary school, like you've talked about your family doing old movies. Was that a family event? You know, because, you know, we did that in my family, too, but it was just my mom and, you know, not my dad. He didn't really participate in the old movies.
You know, it was something, interestingly enough, I discovered on my own. Late nights, summertime, being able to stay up late and, at about midnight every night, our PBS station would show one of probably 12 films they owned, which I presume were in the public domain, which is why they had them and they showed them over and over again. The original A Star Is Born was an early one I remember, a film with Carol Lombard called Made for Each Other.
Yes.
And I just became enraptured by these films depicting other times and places and this whole incredible world of movie stars I knew nothing about. And so I'd go to the library and try to find out about these people, these movies, who made these movies. And it was something that my mother then jumped in on. She remembered being a movie fan when she was younger, and these were movies that she was seeing in the 40s and 50s in the theater for the first time. And now I was discovering them. So it became something that we shared. And my elder brother as well got into the fun of it all. But I really had no idea that would become such an incredible tool and set of knowledge that would serve me in my conversations with Don Bacardi and my work with Don Bacardi. But that's getting a little ahead of myself.
Well, so, you know, in school, you know, I think a lot of, a lot of what we are interested in and sometimes become has those early roots. So were you writing back then? Because it just seems like, and was that, you know, that I'll just leave it there. Were you writing back then?
Yes, I was a voracious reader. And because I was a voracious reader, I just naturally started playing around with words and writing. And in the early days, it was a lot of just copying of things that I saw on TV or things I read in books, you know, taking a story that I know or knew or had some sort of appeal for me and trying to rework it in my own way, maybe changing the ending, for example, to better suit how I thought it should end. But yeah, my interest in writing really sparked early on, and then it got very consumed as I got into high school and college by just academic writing, homework, papers, and my creative writing really took a back seat. It wasn't until years out of college that I really began to return to it, just as an outlet for myself initially. And then when I started meeting some very extraordinary elders and began learning their stories, it just all clicked that I could put that passion, my passion for writing, also my passion for art history, for film history.
And your curiosity about people just shines through your books.
Yeah, and my curiosity about people, it all just came magically together. And it's been a wondrous second act of my life, shall we say.
So your background started leading you to writing. And you started meeting with, like you said, elders and people like that. When did you seriously start thinking about doing something book length? Because that's pretty much of a challenge. I mean, did you do lesser writing like essays and things like that? So tell us about that, the development of your writing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I wrote a few articles here and there. I tried my hand at blogging a bit. I just really couldn't keep it up. And so I was always keeping my hand in a little bit here and there. It was really when I developed an extraordinary friendship with the artist Bernard Perlin and began listening long hours, wondrous hours, to his incredible stories about his most extraordinary life that I began to really think about collaborating with him, in a sense, on a book, in recording what he was saying, in transcribing it, and then writing around his life, filling in the background information for a potential reader. And that book really grew organically over the 3 years that I was lucky enough to know him before he passed away at the age of 95.
So, Michael, how did that convergence happen? How did you become part of that universe?
Well, you know, going back again to my teen years, I had stumbled on a photography book. It was a book of the work of a photographer named George Platt Lines, who was a fashion photographer, a dance photographer in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, but also created a substantial body of work featuring male nudes, which he couldn't publicly show or exhibit or share during his lifetime, during prevailing social and legal restrictions. And through my interest in Lines's extraordinary photography, I began to learn about an artistic circle just as extraordinary that he had been a part of, centered in New York during the mid-century years. And these included artists like Paul Cadmus and George Tooker and Bernard Perlin. Now, Bernard Perlin's name was one that popped up in books I was reading about these other more well-known artists, but I couldn't really find anything about Bernard Perlin, or much anyway, on the internet, although I did discover that he was still alive and seemed to be the last one of them living. So it took me some time to finally get up the nerve to write him a letter. Again, it was just my curiosity about his work, about his life, about that time, about that circle he'd been a part of, these incredible people that he had known. And I wrote him a letter, finally, with my phone number. He called me, and we began this incredible phone conversation. Within 2 months, I was on a plane out to Connecticut, and we had a wonderful weekend of great conversation together. A fast friendship was formed, and my life was absolutely, utterly changed.
Now, the style of your writing with that, yeah, that you developed in the book, and of course, in the book that we'll talk about down the road here, your new one, is a very much of an oral history type of doing it. Now, tell us about how you, when you approach that, and I think there was some pushback about you doing a book that style, but tell us about, you know, doing kind of a, almost really relating an oral history in your book.
Yeah, rather than approach the first book with Bernard Perlin, for example, as a traditional biography, you know, listening to his stories, recording them, doing my own research, and then taking all of those raw materials and then rewriting it myself, you know, as a more traditional narrative covering his life story. I choked on doing it ultimately because Bernard was such an incredible storyteller. And here I had the man himself telling his story in his own unique and wonderful and very descriptive way. Now, of course, our conversations went all over the place, you know, as he would go down delicious rabbit hole, you know, one after another. And so it took a lot of work in transcribing to, you know, pull all the pieces apart and put them back together. But once I put them all back together, I realized he had such a strong voice. I was just really there as a support to help structure it, to help clue readers in on who was who, what's what in terms of the storytelling. And really to help shape it all into a narrative that will, you know, invite in and hold a reader. So that was the way that I approached the first book. And it was a challenge to get it published because it was a really unique format. Ultimately, happily, a publisher in Berlin brought out the book, and it got some wonderful attention and some wonderful awards, for which I was thrilled and very grateful. When I started talking with Don Bacardi and then working with him toward this project, you know, the same bells went off. Don is such an incomparable raconteur, such an incredible storyteller. I knew that I needed to get out of the way of letting him tell his own story, but needed to insert myself on behalf of readers to keep it flowing, keep it structured, and keep them clued in sometimes on who we were talking about or what we're talking about, you know, the context of things. So I've really become passionate about the oral history approach, especially with elders. If they're still here and still able to tell their stories, you know, let's get those recorded and help invite readers in. You know, I'm just there as the bridge between the reader and the storyteller, essentially.
Right.
So, Michael, with Bernard, was he aware that these conversations were going to lead to a book?
Yes, he was. He was. You know, he, before I came on the scene, he had started writing a few essays toward the thought of maybe publishing a memoir. But then in his early 90s, it had become too burdensome for him to do it. And it was really that first weekend together where I just thought I was going to meet him. We were going to have a wonderful conversation, a wonderful time together. But I had brought along my little digital voice recorder. And I said, let's just record. Maybe I can be an assistant to you. Maybe I can record these. I'll transcribe them. And from those transcriptions, you'll be better able to write your memoir. When I gave him the transcriptions after that first weekend, he so liked the conversational format because he thought it sounded more real. No BS, as he said. So he really encouraged me to keep going, for us to keep going. So let's do this. So over the next couple of years, as we got together frequently in Connecticut and we did phone sessions, you know, I just kept the recorder going and we just kept talking.
So with those conversations, and you don't have to answer this because it was also something I was thinking about when reading Don Bacardi. So when you're having a conversation, I mean, things can get even more personal and intimate than you've given in the book. Were there other stories that you needed to adjust or edit?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, in doing a project like the project I did with Don Bacardi, as with Bernard Perlin, you know, certainly when the conversation turned into someone in their lives who are still here, and it right. might have been a little overtly personal, you know, I really needed to walk carefully around some of that material. You know, Bernard, for example, as is Don, they're open books. You know, they're very forthright, very, very honest, and set no parameters whatsoever around what I could or could not share. That said, I'm also sensitive to the fact that, you know, there are people or were people in their lives, you know, that you know, maybe some of this material should be edited. But I have to say that it was pretty minimal.
Yeah, because Don's very almost stream of consciousness. I mean, I would imagine those conversations were quite juicy.
Yes, yes, yeah, they're juicy. And you know, it's really helped as well, especially with the Don Project, to have some wonderful outside eyes read through the manuscript afterwards and, you know, ask me blunt questions about, you know, questions about clarity or what did he mean or, ooh, what do you think? Do you really think this should be there or not in there? You know, just one can get so close to it in the relationship mm-hmm. right. with, you know, this person you're interviewing that sometimes it's hard to step back and see objectively where something might become a little insensitive or might become a little too much information being shared or not enough information being right. shared, you know, so it was very helpful for me.
Was there anything, you know, you approach this project and of course, as the oral history you're taking down, was there things about that you went in with a preconceived notion that then it surprised you as he, you know, revealed his own personal story and journey?
Yeah, absolutely. It, with both of these projects in terms of Bernard and Don, you know, often I would come to the table with a set of questions and an expectation on my part of where the conversation was going or where I thought I needed the conversation to go, you know, uh-huh. right? and invariably with both of them, we'd be talking about something, you know, for example, Bernard was, you know, we'd be talking about, and I was at this party at Leonard Bernstein's house, da, 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 da. And then I walked out of there, and then Truman Capote said this to me. Have I ever told you my big story about Truman Capote? Well, Truman Capote may not have been on my list of questions to ask when I walked in that day, but boy, did I want to hear that story right then and there while he was fresh with it. So, yeah, there were so many and are so many twists and turns with these conversations that I've really learned to, yes, have my notes, yes, have my questions and my loose direction, but essentially just fasten my seatbelt and just let it go, because I can always go back, and if something is missed that I needed, I can always go back and clarify. Right.
What I loved about the book, Michael, was just kind of that fact that, especially with like Don Bacardi, throughout the book, he has conflicting stories about things. And so I felt like I was actually in the room when I was reading the book. You know, I really felt part of the conversation and that it was real because of that, because we change our mind. Like, he might have been talking to you 1 year and then the next year he feels differently about something, and all that's kind is in the book. So
thank you. Exactly. I really want these conversations to be fresh and real and human, particularly with an elder looking back on a life of accomplishment, of extraordinary accomplishment. And as they're, you know, reviewing and sharing perspectives on it all, you know, I think it's important to capture the richness of how complex we all are as human beings, even as we age and we look back on things with regret, or maybe put a little sugar coating on something in hindsight, or, you know, all of it. I think it's very fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And I titled my first book on Bernard Perlin, One Man Show, because I had such a feeling so often sitting, you know, over multiple drinks in his living room on a Saturday night, us just one-on-one engaged in glorious conversation with my recorder going between us, that I was the privileged audience of one to this extraordinary one-man theatrical show, this person just there sharing their story, their stories. And that, I never thought that I would be able to have that experience again until Don Bacardi and discovered yet again that I have had the privilege of sitting one-on-one, hearing his extraordinary story. And so I wanted to pull audiences into that, readers. I wanted readers to have that same sense of being in the room, and keep our conversations just very natural and flowing. And
Well, you're listening to our guest today, Michael Schreiber, on Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP 103.1 FM.
So, Michael, can you do a reading from Don Bacardi for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to read just the opening of the introduction that I wrote to the book, as the book is essentially a long conversation in oral history. It might be a little wild for me to speak as myself and then speak as Don, but I thought what I would do instead is just give you a little bit of the setup.
Perfect.
Okay. I've never sat so still or so silently or for as long as I have during my portrait sittings with Don Bacardi. I've never been so intensely looked at either by anyone, or felt so deeply looked into, so thoroughly seen. In his preferred work uniform, colorfully painted shorts, tank top, and sneakers, Don could lay perfectly camouflaged across the equally paint-spattered floor of his studio. But even starkly framed against the room's sunlit white walls, he seems in moments to almost disappear. So total is his absorption in recording his subject, me. It's as though he has somehow absorbed himself into me. The resulting portraits are more than just accurate likenesses of me. They're ghosts of me, with my essence also nakedly captured on paper in vibrant colors that almost palpably radiate. They're the me from the outside looking in, yet also the me from the inside looking out. It's truly an eerie experience, to say the least, looking at a mirror image of oneself, yet also from it feeling oneself from outside of oneself. But mine are not unusual among the thousands of portraits Don has channeled through his skilled eye and hand over the past 60 years. Through just an economy of brush strokes, time and again, he captures in his work both the physicality and the energetic imprint of his subjects, whether they be of celebrities or everyday people like myself. Don's portraits reveal the extraordinary in even the most ordinary of faces.
You know, you talked about your portrait, but he has an extraordinary who's who of people that he's done portraits of. So maybe relate some of those people. And of course, they could find it out in your book, and that would be the ultimate way to find out. But some of the people, and actually fairly contemporary people that he's done.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, over the course of a now 60-plus year career, it's estimated that Don has created something like 15,000 portraits. Now, often in a session, especially in his prime, he would do 2 to 3 portraits in one session of one particular person. Now, of course, of those 15,000, a fraction are celebrities, but that fraction still probably accounts for several thousand. And among those people are, you know, major stars of the past 60 years. If you go back, Bette Davis, Joan Crawford, Vivian Leigh, Montgomery Clift, Natalie Wood,
Marilyn Monroe.
Well, Marilyn Monroe was someone that Don had met as a teenager when he and his brother, living in L.A., began gatecrashing Hollywood movie premieres, sneaking into Hollywood movie premieres, which is a fascinating story. This is, you know, Don as a teenager, before he has met Christopher Isherwood, he and his brother are huge movie fans. And they got themselves into these movie premieres and got up close to incredible people with their autograph book and their Brownie camera, and you know, met people like Elizabeth Taylor and Marilyn Monroe and so many, many, many others. When Don then later became a portrait artist, many of these people ultimately sat for him. And going into more contemporary people, in more recent years, he's done portraits of Reese Witherspoon, Tilda Swinton, Mark Ruffalo. Going back a few years into the 90s, he did people who are still huge. Their careers are massive, like Robert Downey Jr., Julianne Moore, Frances McDormand. So it's an incredible inventory of famous names and faces.
Well, even the praise for the book, I mean, Liza Minnelli and Joel Grey, and just, it just goes on and on. Robert Wagner, it's just amazing.
So
thanks to your, I mean, I've had just the best time with the research on you and then following, you know, the trails that everything goes, like The Single Man by Tom Ford. Wow.
What an extraordinary film.
What a film.
Yeah.
So I can see that's probably how he did Julianne, is possibly through the movie, or?
Actually, before the movie, interestingly enough, in 92, there was a Robert Altman film called Shortcuts. Not sure if you...
Right,
Yeah, with a huge ensemble cast. Wonderful, wonderful film. And one of the producers of the film got the idea that they would hire Don to do portraits of everyone in the cast. And his portraits are actually shown in the film because there is a one of the characters is an artist. So all of the stars of that film were obliged to sit for Don. So he got Jack Lemmon and Lily Tomlin, and that's when Julianne Moore, she was a part of the film, came, and Frances McDormand, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Robert Altman himself sat for him.
Right.
Yeah, and then as time went on, you know, people like James Marsden. It's been an incredible, incredible long list of celebrities. Don, some years back, not too many years back, published a wonderful coffee table book, appropriately titled Hollywood, of his Hollywood portraiture.
Yeah, I can't imagine anyone else in that role but her. I mean, after seeing her in it, she's just luminescent in it.
She's great. And you know, just to let your listeners know, A Single Man is a novel by Don's, was based on a novel by Don's partner, the writer Christopher Isherwood. And it is an exquisite, exquisite book about the day in a life, a day in the life of a gay English professor living, Englishman, who was a professor living in Los Angeles in the early 1960s. And Tom Ford, the incredible fashion designer, made his first foray into directing, into filmmaking with this film, an adaptation of the book. And it is an exquisite film. And Don makes a cameo appearance in a faculty lounge. You see him. Colin Firth walks by.
Looking at his style, and I know this is radio and we can't really show his work, so I encourage people to go do a search online. How would you describe his style of portraiture, which is, you know, it's got a uniqueness to it, and it's not that it's realistic, but it's very, very impressionistic, I guess is the word I would use.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. You know, for many decades, Don worked in pen and ink with his drawings, you know, so they're very stark, black and white, very realistic depictions of his subjects. But from the late 70s on, he moved into painting his portraits, and he paints from a really wide palette of colors, and just organically in the moment, you know, as he's looking.
He seems so free, doesn't it? When he's got the paint, it frees him up.
It frees him
in a beautiful way.
It does. His style got a little looser.
Yeah.
You know, very precise when he was drawing, but when he began painting his subjects, certainly, yes, you're right. It freed his work. Nevertheless, they're all incredibly accurate likenesses.
Completely, yeah.
Completely, completely accurate, but colorful, just vibrantly colorful. You know, oranges and reds and yellows and greens and blues, you name it. You know, it's just an intuitive process too when he's working with a subject, you know, as what he'll dip his paintbrush in.
Right, because when he was doing the drawings, it almost, you get the sense that so many, or most of the time, it was an excruciating process for him. And so you still have that detail in the face, but then the rest of it just becomes, like when he added the paint, the rest of it just becomes so expressive.
It's so expressive and so vibrant. And it's when I say, you know, that they seem to palpably radiate an energy. I, you know, the experience for me of sitting for Don, as I have a couple of times, and then afterwards, immediately afterwards, he'll show you the painting, because Don uniquely has his subjects sign his paintings, his portraits of them, because he considers it a collaboration between between the artist and his sitter. So you see yourself immediately, and it's truly an emotional experience. They're just, as I said, they're full of energy, so vibrant, incredible.
And you're listening to our guest on Art of the Air today, Michael Schreiber. And you're listening on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM. It's amazing to see his self-portraits and the different permutations of that. You know, there's some that are very, very kind of realistic and others that are extremely, like, the colors are just all over the place.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, even with his self-portraits, as he has approached all of his portraits throughout his career, it's all done very honestly, very non-judgmentally. So a lot of his sitters, myself included, might be a little shocked sometimes, you know, immediately after the sitting to take a look at your portrait and see what you might perceive to be a flaw in your features, or, you know, or that somehow you seem sad. That's something that he's told me, that so many of his sitters have told him afterwards, is that they seem sad. A lot of it is that it's just really hard to sit so still for so long and smile and try to, you know, try to think you're projecting your most glamorous face. And Don is just recording as he sees what he sees. You know, it's all very, very
at the moment,
like a photograph. But he gets, rather than being an artist, many portrait artists, they'll have you come in, you'll sit, they'll take a lot of photographs from you, they'll send you away, and then they'll work from the photographs of you. Don has never wanted to do that, because it's something about the energetic exchange in the moment and about the animation of the real live human creature in three dimensions sitting right there in front of him that really inspires him, motivates his work. So he just paints what he sees in that moment, flaws and all, again, without judgment. But it's pretty extraordinary.
I don't know if you can answer this or not, but I was, like, the part in the book about Joan Crawford signing it like she was signing a fan photo. Why was he so upset about that he left her out? I mean, he was very, like, in his conversation with you, he was adamant that he thought that it would look bad for her, or?
Yeah. So, you know, as I mentioned, Don has his sitters, whether they're celebrities or just an everyday person like myself, sign their portrait afterwards. And so he did a portrait sitting with Joan Crawford. He had had several encounters with her. First, early on, as a teenager, crashing movie premieres, he had met her, and she was very gracious to a young fan. She didn't remember that later on, but socially, through Isherwood, he had met her, and he had the opportunity to go to her New York apartment and do a portrait drawing of her, for which she graciously sat. After the portrait sitting was done, as he usually does, he hands her the drawing to sign. And instead of just signing her name, she took it as though it was a fan handing her an 8x10 glossy photograph to sign. You know, dearest Don, you know, love Joan with much love. And she just went on and on and on. And for Don, as an artist and exhibiting his artwork, he decided not to put that portrait in a show, because all of a sudden it changed the tenor of the rest of his work. You know, it cast him into the position of maybe looking like a fan,
right,
and not an artist. And his portraits of Crawford are incredible. They're gorgeous. They are she, you know, but I understandably so, from, you know, he walked a fine line for a lot of years in Hollywood. He is unabashedly a movie fan and a Hollywood movie fan, but he's also an artist and wants to be and deserves to be taken seriously as an artist. And so that was just a too fine of a line to cross.
Do you think he changed his mind on that now today?
Oh, I think he would. I think he would, as long as the context is there. You know, that's why the story is in the book. It's such a fascinating story about Don now is talking more and more about the intersection of Hollywood and his being a movie fan with his artwork. And certainly it was an influence from him from the get-go, from being a real young kiddo, like 4 or 5 years old. His mother was pulling him out of school, and his older brother as well, because they were her movie-going companions, and they would see movies constantly, and movie close-ups, close-ups in movies, seeing faces huge on a screen are what first fascinated Don about, you know, people and humanity. And he began copying close-ups, close-up pictures of movie stars from movie magazines as a young boy. And that was really the origins of what later became this extraordinary artistic career as an artist, as a portrait artist.
I figured he must have been like quite a dynamic personality during them, because even when a sitter didn't enjoy their photo, they still signed it for him, even though they might have never spoken to him again.
Yeah. You know?
So I feel like they still had a rapport, even if they didn't quite like what he did.
What I was curious about is, you know, you've completed this project and it's just coming out. The official release date is, I think, October 28th. And we'll talk a little bit about where people can find your book. But what's your next project there? Do you have that on the horizon?
I do. Actually, I have two projects right now in the works. One is a book of the letters between Bernard Perlin, going back to Bernard, and George Platt Lines, the photographer.
Oh, good.
Yeah, they had an incredible correspondence back and forth that Bernard actually wanted to get published, or was hoping that it would be published posthumously. So right now I'm in the process of editing that. And I'm also now just beginning research work toward a biography of Mark Crowley, who was a playwright. He wrote the groundbreaking play, The Boys in the Band, in the 1960s. He was also a Hollywood writer. He wrote and produced many episodes of Heart to Heart, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful show.
Right.
He was Natalie Wood's best friend. Just an extraordinary character. And The Boys in the Band was revived on Broadway for its 50th anniversary. Not all that long back, with a stellar cast. And Ryan Murphy made that into a movie. So, but the Crowley project, Mark Crowley project, I'm going to try my hand at writing a more traditional biography. Unfortunately, he passed away a couple of years ago. So, but I'm excited to flex my creative muscles in that way.
Well, I'll look forward to that.
And this is something, the side question real quick. What do you like to do outside of writing? What's something that Michael likes to do?
Well, my husband, Jason, and I, we just bought a house in Chicago. So right now, all hands have been on settling in and decorating. But what I'm very excited about is I have a little postage stamp of a backyard, and I have the opportunity to garden. I've not been able to do it in the past couple of years. And so I'm really, really excited about that. And when I'm not outside doing that during the winter months, I am plunked down in front of Turner Classic Movies. I am still a diehard old movie fan. I'm either watching an old movie, or I'm reading a biography, or reading a book about old Hollywood, or going to one of our wonderful theaters here in Chicago where occasionally silent films are screened. Those are tremendous joys of mine.
Well, in our couple moments here, we want to give you a chance to tell how people can first of all find out about you, like your website, and also the availability of your book, where it can be found coming out on, I know October 28th is the official release date, but tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the book is out on October 28th, and you can find out more information about the book and about myself on my website, which is michaeljschreiber.com. And it's not an easy last name to spell. It's S-C-H-R-E-I-B-E-R. The book will be widely available through your local bookseller and certainly your online sources, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, et cetera, et cetera. But I do hope that you will support your local bookseller.
Yeah, that's always a good thing. We thanks to Ann Pryor to hooking us up initially for this interview. And you can find also, we will have your picture on our website, which will have a link to your website, and then they can get everything information about that. Michael Schreiber, who is the author of Don Bacardi, An Artist's Life, and you can, again, released on October 28th. It's a hardcover, and it's a beautiful book. It takes you through a whole great journey about a one-man show and the life of him and the oral history. Michael, thank you so much for coming on Art of the Air, sharing not only your journey, but the journey through creating this wonderful piece of literature.
Well, thank you, Larry and Esther, and thank you all for tuning in. I've appreciated this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michael. It's been such a pleasure, completely.
Cheers. Thanks so much.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Media, 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicmedia.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Media's website as a podcast. Art on the Air is also heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org. If you have a smart speaker like Amazon Alexa, Google Assistant, or Apple Siri, just tell to play Art on the Air to hear the latest episode. Our spotlight interviews are heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Media. Thanks to Dee Dotson, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Media, and to Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Lakeshore Public Media, Ember Forge Consulting, Thoughtful Marketing and Digital Learning, built to express your purpose and grow your reach. Learn more at emberforgeconsulting.com/grow. And for WVLP, Walt Reitinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art in the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good. You'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event or exhibit, please email us at AOTA@breck.com. That's AOTA@breck.com. BRECH.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know. Esther and Larry are on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Are on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.